Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we spend the hour with Pulitzer Prize winner Chris Hedges. We'll discuss his new book and much more, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we talk with author and Pulitzer Prize winner Chris Hedges. His newest of 11 books is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He spent nearly two decades as a correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times. He's the author of numerous best-selling books, including Empire of Illusion, Death of the Liberal Class, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which he co-wrote with Joe Sacco. He writes a weekly column for the online magazine Truth Dig and lives in Princeton, New Jersey. Chris Hedges joins the program today by phone.
Chris, the book Wages of Rebellion, A Moral Imperative of Revolt. What compelled you to write this and lay out the main premise for us?
Well, I had written three previous books, Death of the Liberal Class, that talked about the disintegration of liberal institutions, including the Democratic Party, that had once made incremental and piecemeal reform possible. Empire of Illusion, the end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle, the rise of the image-based or spectacle-based society, the severance from a print-based culture, and the ramifications of that. And then a book called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which I did with the cartoonist Joe Sacco, where we went to the poorest pockets of the United States, for instance, Camden, New Jersey, per capita, the poorest city in the United States, and wrote about these sacrifice zones, these places that have been sacrificed by unfettered, unregulated corporate capitalism. The coal fields of southern West Virginia is another place we wrote about, and argued that we're all one vast sacrifice zone now in the age of global warming, and it's incumbent upon people to look at what's happened in those places that went first. What happened to the environment, what happened to communities, what happened to families, what happened to law, where essentially corporations, let's say in southern West Virginia, the coal companies, write the school textbooks, own the judges, own the state legislatures, own the senators, own the governors, own the press. And that's something that's now being writ large across the country. This book was a departure from those three in that it talked about the nature of resistance or revolt, the cost of rebellion, what the state does to those who rebel, the kinds of qualities that are needed. I interview people like Ronnie Cusreels, who founded the armed wing of the ANC, with Nelson Mandela, Mumia Abu-Jamal, Julian Assange, all sorts of figures who have resisted, in many cases paid a terrific price for that resistance. Because when you defy systems of power, especially totalitarian power, on that level, the consequences are often extremely grave. And kind of posited, as the subtitle suggests, that in an age of radical evil, to steal a line from Immanuel Kant, which we certainly live in, resistance is finally validated not for what we achieve, but for who it allows us to become as individuals. And I think the most difficult existential crisis of our age is to grasp at once the bleakness of the reality around us, especially in terms of climate change, and yet resist anyway.
Chris Hedges, let's discuss what exactly it is that we are rebelling against. And of course, you connect a lot of dots in your various works over the years. And one of the concepts that recurs in your writing, of course, also in Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, is the concept of Sheldon Wallen, of inverted totalitarianism.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that more specifically?
Yeah, Sheldon Wallen, who we just lost at the age of, I think, 92 or 93 a few weeks ago, I think is our most important contemporary political philosopher. And I did a long, almost three-hour interview with him on YouTube that I think is worth watching. Wallen, who taught at Berkeley and then later at Princeton, formulated this concept about the structures of power we live in, and he calls those structures inverted totalitarianism. By that, he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. So in a classical totalitarian regime, you have a party, fascist, communist would be an example, who seizes power and overthrows the system. In inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, you know, basic constitutional rights, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet internally have seized the levers of power to render the citizen impotent. It's what the Canadian philosopher John Rolston Saul calls our corporate coup d'etat in slow motion. That seizure of major institutions, from the press to elected bodies to academia to the two major political parties, by a cabal of corporatists, global corporatists, who divert power, divert the mechanisms of state to serve their own interests. And that's what Wolin, I think, identified in his last book, Democracy Incorporated.
Chris, you'd use the terminology political demobilization of the citizenry, and that's part of an extension of what you're talking about in terms of inverted totalitarianism. How does that work in terms of the media and public education? Some of these are major institutions.
Well, you're depoliticized, one, through the destruction of organizations such as labor unions that once gave a voice. And you ideologically invert traditional forms of representation. For example, feminism. Feminism no longer is about empowering and advancing the rights of oppressed women, but feminism is about electing your first woman president. This is, you know, embodied in Barack Obama as a black president, but one who, as Cornel West says, serves as a black mascot for Wall Street. So it is about the redefinition of traditional concepts. It is about the society of spectacle. You know, we invest tremendous amounts of our intellectual and emotional energy into spectacle, from professional sports to reality television to, it's kind of endless. And you essentially effectively demobilize the citizenry, either through these kind of electronic hallucinations or by redefining terms, which we've seen in court decisions such as Citizens United, where the Supreme Court rules that unlimited corporate campaign contributions are the right to petition the government, or a form of free speech. So you keep the traditional iconography, you keep the traditional language of a capitalist democracy, but you invert the meaning. I think that's what Wolin's getting at when he talks about inverted totalitarianism. The superstructure, the facade, is there, but underneath, the citizen is rendered impotent, and I think that's precisely what's happened.
Chris Hedges, so many directions to go here in your writing over the years, and certainly this book, Wages of Rebellion. I wanted to take this direction here momentarily. You write in your book, in a chapter called The Rebel Caged, you have a quote here by West that says, "No longer has a legitimacy or significant foothold. The black prophetic tradition," you write, West says, "no longer has legitimacy or significant foothold in the minds of black masses. And with the corporate media and narrowing of the imagination of all Americans, including black people, there is an erasure of memory. And this is the near death of the black prophetic tradition. It's a grave issue. It's a matter of life and death. It means that the major roadblock to American fascism, which has been the black prophetic tradition, is gone. And to imagine America without the black prophetic tradition, from Frederick Douglass to Fannie Lou Hamer, means the American authoritarian regime. It means that it's American fascism, essentially, is what West is laying out here, and this is what you're talking about. Can you relate that to, more recently, the experiences you've had with Black Lives Matter and other protests around the United States, and how they fit into this, possibly fit into this tradition, this black prophetic tradition?
Well, this is what Parnell very correctly highlights, that the Black prophetic tradition has been, in many ways, our most important intellectual tradition, because it always understood the nature of empire. African Americans had suffered internally from, you know, imperialism, in essence, in the same way Native Americans suffered from white supremacy and imperialism. And that always gave the Black prophetic tradition a special understanding of, you know, what it meant for instance, Filipinos to be occupied in 1898 by the United States, what it meant for Vietnamese to be invaded. And that has been, among many contributions, an extremely important contribution to our understanding of empire and of imperialism. And the assault against the Black prophetic tradition, which is embodied in intellectuals like Cornel West, and I would argue in groups like the Black Lives Matter, has been set against an accommodationist movement within African American society, embodied by figures like Al Sharpton or Barack Obama or others.
Chris Hedges used that term accommodationist, that hearkening back to Booker T. Washington.
Yeah, and I think Cornell would draw distinctions between this form of accommodationist politics and Booker T., that it has different characteristics. But what it is, in essence, I mean, certainly this is Cornell's concern, is that a tiny segment of the Black elite is pushed forward to carry out the bidding of the corporate and imperial state, and often essentially serve as a mask for the systems of white supremacy that remain firmly in place. And it's no coincidence that the Obama White House has declared war against Cornel West, trying to shut down his voice. You know, figures like Michael Eric Dyson, who kind of carry water for the administration, have unleashed very vicious forms of character assassination against Cornel because he names those accommodationists for who they are. And if you listen to Black radio, that sort of strain of propagandists refer to him as a race traitor because he criticizes the president. So I think Cornell's right that Black intellectuals in this country, and you could argue that W.E.B. Du Bois was perhaps our greatest intellectual because of this, always had an understanding of the nature of empire and the poison of empire, not only abroad but at home. And there are very few sort of white intellectual traditions that carry that. Maybe the Anti-Imperialist League did, certainly Eugene Debs did with the socialists, but that has certainly been one of many contributions of the Black prophetic tradition, which Cornell worries is essentially being so far pushed to the margins that it could be silenced.
Chris, you talk about Crane Britton's work, Anatomy of Revolution. You lay out correctly, I believe, the idea that the lowest classes are seldom stimulating a revolution, but it really comes from a citizenry, working class, people who have had expectations of where they were going that have been denied. And so ideas of resistance emerge from people who have resources. In fact, sociology looks at revolution in terms of mobilization of resources and selective ideas and manifestations of that. So you're saying that inside of that, though, there's also what Marx calls a lumpen proletariat. And you're warning that the hyper-masculine white males will be, in particular, racist, homophobic, defiant, will be part of the counterattack against Occupy groups and mobilization groups.
Right. We're already seeing that. What's happened is that with essentially decision by liberal elites to focus on what I would call boutique kind of activism, multiculturalism and diversity, which is all fine, but ignore the economic assault against the poor and the working class. They have created, you know, a terrible schism between the working class, especially the white working class, and these college-educated elites. And that's actually something that I looked at in my last column on Truthdig, The Age of the Demagogues, which was posted on November 29th.
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask you about that, Chris Hedges, because midway down you're talking about Russell Jacoby, The End of Utopia.
Right.
And yeah, so yeah, go ahead and continue with that.
Well, I like Jacoby, and I think he makes in The End of Utopia, which, as you correctly point out, I quote in this column, you know, an important point about what's happened within liberal elites. So the corporate state was never threatened by this call for diversity, nor was it ever threatened by the right-wing calls for Christian values. You know, these culture wars are anti-politics, which masquerade as politics, but they're not politics. They never questioned or examined the nature of neoliberalism, of globalization, or of our imperial project. So it left the dictates of the marketplace, the primacy of corporate profit, as well as the military-industrial complex untouched. Meanwhile, the distress of the underclass was mounting, not only through outsourcing of jobs and automation, but the programs of austerity that were cutting the few services left for the underclass. So the calls for cultural diversity, while done so in the name of people of color and women and others, was primarily an elitist game. And that's how you get this notion of feminism, you know, no longer being about empowering marginalized women, but electing your first woman president or having your first woman CEO. And this is something that Jacoby discussed in The End of Utopia, where he points out that really what this was about was not radical change or revolution. It was a form of patronage. It was an ability to get a tiny segment of those who had been marginalized into the structures of power itself. And he said that this whole movement is kind of, I think correctly, devoid of any kind of real political vision or program, and does nothing to challenge the monoculturism of corporatism itself. And that's what has perhaps legitimately enraged the white underclass. So while they are watching this rhetoric and seeing calls to, you know, include GBLT and others, they feel utterly abandoned, which they have been, by liberal institutions and by the liberal elites. And so you get this very frightening backlash where all of the traditional liberal values, including tolerance and the calls to not only include other people within the society, but eradicate the kind of bigotry and racism and sexism, you know, they embrace that bigotry, they embrace that racism, that as a kind of way to push back against liberal elites that they feel betrayed by. Richard Rorty, in his last book, Achieving Our Country, Leftist Thought in the 20th Century and 20th Century America, very presciently calls this out and argues that all of the gains that have been made in the last few decades by people of color, by homosexuals, will be wiped out, and that, you know, all of the contempt for minorities, for women, for GBLT people are once again going to come back to infect a disintegrating society. And we see it in Trump rallies, where not only does Trump overtly cater to racism, but defends mob violence against a African-American protester in the Black Lives Matter movement that showed up at one of his rallies. So these are what Marx would call the lumpen proletariat, and Marx had probably more disdain than he should have for the lumpen proletariat, but he always saw, I think correctly, that the forces of reaction, even fascism, can draw heavily from this disenfranchised and alienated class. And I think that's what we're seeing. We see it with militias. We see it with the Tea Party. We see it with the Christian right. We see it with the gun lobby. They're all there, and they function as proto-fascists always function, in that they direct their rage towards the vulnerable, towards Muslims, towards undocumented workers, towards homosexuals, feminists, liberals, intellectuals. And that, you know, as our society unravels, is going to be a very frightening undercurrent, because they have a propensity towards violence, and they're armed.
We're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist Chris Hedges. His newest book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. We'll continue our conversation with Chris Hedges after this brief musical break. Please stay with us.
Chris, let's get back to some politics. You mentioned Trump, and you're saying that it's this white, lower end of society person who strongly feels negatively towards liberal values and minority rights and gay, lesbian support and those sorts of issues are part of Trump's appeal. Are politics beyond us now? I mean, do we really have, you talk about the two parties being very similar. Is there an opportunity inside the electoral process to make revolutionary change in America today?
No, because on all of the major structural issues, there is no difference between Democrats and Republicans. Neither of the parties did anything to protect wages, which have declined or stagnated since the 70s. They have not addressed the chronic unemployment and underemployment. They've done nothing to address the foreclosure and bank repossessions that are inflicting communities. They have served the interests of banks which carried out the fraud that caused those foreclosures and bank repossessions by allowing them to loot the U.S. Treasury. They have pushed through these disastrous trade agreements, NAFTA, WTO, and now the TPP, which essentially wrest power from government to protect the rights of workers, protect wages, protect the environment. They have colluded to strip us of our most basic constitutional rights and build the most sophisticated and pervasive security and surveillance apparatus in human history. And I covered the Stasi state in East Germany. They have both collaborated to carry out these endless wars in the Middle East, which have failed. I mean, the Taliban controls more territory in Afghanistan than when we arrived. Iraq, as a unified country, has become, I suppose you could argue, fractured into three different entities with the rise of failed states and groups like ISIS. They colluded to rewrite the laws, which, under some of the Clinton administration, exploded our prison population, militarized our police, and wiped out our most important social service programs, including, courtesy of Bill Clinton, welfare. And under the old welfare program before Clinton destroyed it, 70% of the recipients were children. So, you know, this is what, when John Ralston Saul speaks about a corporate coup d'etat, this is what he means. And the culture wars were used to divert citizens from real politics so that they would argue about gay rights or gun laws or affirmative action or abortion or something like this. And I think the game's over. I think that there are so many people in the white underclass who realize that all of the elites in both of the parties have betrayed them, as they have, that they're kind of fodder for anyone, no matter how buffoonish, who promises them that the people who wrong them will be swept from power and the country will be renewed and find moral greatness and celebrates these kind of hyper-masculine values that are portrayed as an antidote to the kind of decay around us. And again, both parties do it. But this kind of hero worship of the military, this blind celebration of American power, the sanctification of the military and military values, is really laying the ideological framework for an authoritarian, if not totalitarian, police state as we continue this kind of downward economic spiral.
A follow-up question on that then would be, how do you handle the idea of liberal democracy, voting rights? Half the people don't vote generally. Would you recommend third parties, or would you say that it's beyond any impact in terms of electoral politics at this point?
Well, I mean, as Emma Goldman once said, if voting was that effective, it would be illegal. fundamental change in the society never came from voting. It came from building movements, as Howard Zinn pointed out in the People's History of the United States. The entire system was designed as a closed system. It was a system that was dominated by white, male, aristocratic slaveholders. It excluded women, African Americans, Native Americans, even white men without property. It made direct democracy impossible. That's the Electoral College. And that's how Al Gore can get 500,000 more votes, popular votes, than George W. Bush. And George W. Bush ends up as president, appointed by judicial fiat by the Supreme Court. And so, as Zinn chronicles in that book, every opening in American democracy was paid for with the blood of African-American civil rights leaders and labor leaders. We had the bloodiest labor wars in U.S. history, the suffragists, the abolitionists, and our movements have been destroyed, largely were destroyed in the name of anti-communism. But we have to recover those movements in order to hold power in check. In that sense, you know, power is always the problem. Many of us on the left forgot that it's not our job to take power. It's our job to build movements so that power is forced to respond. And that's why the last liberal president, as Ralph Nader correctly points out, in the United States, was Richard Nixon. Not because he was a liberal or he had compassion or a conscience, but because he was still frightened of movements. And you had a raft of legislation, which has not been matched since, OSHA, the Mine and Safety Act, the Clean Water Act. All this was much of it written by Nader. All of it was passed by Nixon because there were powerful grassroots movements, including the anti-war movement.
Yeah, Chris,
that frightened him.
It's interesting that you point out that Nader observation in terms of historiographically, of course, a lot of us on the left, we see Nixon, of course, as a right wing, not to be hyperbolic, but tyrannical or a power or control freak in various ways. And yet what you just described is illustrative of how far to the right that the United States has slid in the last near half century. And of course, you've chronicled this in many of your books, including American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War on America. So you've actually been talking about this age of demagogues for quite a while, and you certainly outlined what helped contribute to that in your Empire of Illusion book, The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. I've used that in several of my classes over the years. And naturally, that seems to me like a trajectory from people like Neil Postman. I'd like to turn a little bit to the role of media and our infotainment complex, and you certainly write about that in all of your works. And naturally, at Project Censored, that's what we've been doing for nearly four decades. You write in your newest book, Wages of Rebellion, totalitarian states use propaganda to orchestrate historical amnesia, a state-induced stupidity. The object is to make sure the populace does not remember what it means to be free, and once a population does not remember what it means to be free, it does not react when freedom is stripped from it. I mean, that really is descriptive of the last couple of decades, to be sure. Certainly post 9/11, one would think people paying attention would note that that has been incredibly obvious. It's also quite devastating. Popular culture films like Idiocracy, they now, as satire, appear to be more and more where we're heading. Could you comment a little bit more about the role of media and propaganda in our current affairs?
Well, you're referring to that great book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, by Neil Postman, which is brilliant. I think it was written in 85, and it's
yes,
it is a stunning book. Well, you've had the systems of information seized by roughly a half dozen corporations. We're talking about the electronic airwaves. Viacom, General Electric, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Clear Channel, Disney. And it's different from the old media empires, like the old Hearst newspaper empire, where you had media empires that were controlled by oligarchic elites and served the interests of those elites. Now, within a large corporation like Viacom, these media revenue streams are just one of hundreds of streams, and they compete with all the other streams, and they compete on the basis of being able to generate revenue, advertising dollars, which are, you know, make ratings kind of crucial. And we've seen the incredible degeneration of, you know, I wouldn't even call it journalism, what passes for journalism now on the airwaves, on corporate-controlled airwaves, where there is no real divergence between supposedly left and right It is what Sigmund Freud once called the narcissism of minor difference. So the debate in Syria, and I speak as someone who spent 7 years in the Middle East. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. I spent months of my life in Iraq. The debate over Middle Eastern policy, and we can look at the calls to intervene in against ISIS in Syria, is kind of emblematic. And the debate goes like this. Should we bomb them, or should we bomb them and put boots on the ground, as if those are the only two viable alternatives, without any understanding of what has gone into creating ISIS and why 14 years after launching these wars in the Middle East, we are facing the specter of these failed states and radical jihadist groups. The idea that the industrial violence that gave birth to these movements is somehow going to be an antidote to these movements is a form of collective insanity. But without context, without any kind of historical understanding, through this kind of corporate-induced amnesia, we don't even know how we got to where we are. And if we don't know how we got to where we are, we can't respond rationally. And that's unfortunately what's happened. We are kind of entranced by these electronic hallucinations, which we are bombarded with now on handheld devices. And yet we know almost nothing about a world where we are projecting tremendous military power. You can't understand the Middle East unless you have read and grasped the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement or what took place in 1948 in Palestine or the kind of conflicts that have raged, the sectarian conflicts that have raged throughout the Middle East that color present history. And to sort of react emotionally or instinctively without grasping the long antecedents that went into creating what it is we're dealing with is a kind of self-induced blindness. And it's very, very frightening. But you're not going to get it off the media. The media now is completely emotionally driven, I mean almost hyperbolically so, and the commercial media, its final goal is not to transmit information, but to bring in larger and larger revenue streams through advertising and increase ratings.
Chris Hedges, I couldn't help but think of Gore Vidal in the United States of Amnesia. You're talking
yeah.
about the vacuum, the historical vacuum. I teach history, and it's pretty amazing to see kind of collectively, term after term, the issues that are created from historical ignorance. We're speaking with award-winning author Chris Hedges. His latest book is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. You can read his weekly columns at truthdig.com. And after this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation with Chris Hedges. Please stay with us.
Welcome back. We're interviewing Chris Hedges. I'd like to ask now, you use the term inverted totalitarianism as corporate power and political demobilization of the citizenry. And in a world of globalization, in a world of U.S.-NATO military bases all over the world, is this global now? Are we really talking about a transnational kind of corporate class of private corporations ruling the world?
Yeah, it is a kind of global neo-feudalism, where you have, and that's what these trade agreements like TPP are about. They are about giving global corporate entities the power to overrule the sovereignty of states. And the TPP is an example of, I mean, Ralph Nader calls it the most obscene power grab, corporate power grab, or the most brazen corporate power grab in American history. And Ralph, as usual, is right, along with the WTO, the World Trade Organization, and the North American Free Trade Agreement. I mean, we see it now. We have a climate conference in Paris with non-binding agreements that if the TPP, this is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, is passed, essentially obliterates the capacity of individual states to impose environmental regulations along with protect wages and working conditions and everything else. So, yes, it is very much global, and it has created mechanisms to hollow countries, including our own, out from the inside. You know, the TPP, in essence, if it's voted, and it's only an up and down vote, there's going to be no debate. This is part of what Fast Track, which is a sleazy mechanism to destroy democratic debate that Richard Nixon thought up. It can't have any amendments. It can't have any changes. It's a straight majority. It's not like a filibuster. But it removes significant legislative authority from both Congress and the White House on a series of issues. It surrenders large parts of judicial authority to this three-person trade tribunal, which only corporations are permitted to use. So if you're a worker or an environmental advocacy group or a labor union, you can't even seek redress in these tribunals. In essence, you know, the rights of corporations are elevated and are unassailable, while the rights of citizens are further diminished and in many cases abolished. So yes, it is global, and it is harnessed to a global security and surveillance apparatus unlike anything we have seen throughout human history, and has the makings of a very terrifying dystopia.
Chris Hedges, you talk in your book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt, you talk about a number of groups and individuals that are revolting against this kind of totalitarian culture, both globally and here in the United States. And of course, you mentioned the significance, the importance historically of whistleblowers. Naturally, in more recent memory, you mentioned Chelsea Manning, of course, Edward Snowden, many others in the vein of Daniel Ellsberg, whether they be Thomas Drake or others. But you spend some time in the book talking about someone who at least I don't believe has received adequate attention, which is why it was refreshing, I think, and significant to see in your book that you spent some time talking about the Jeremy Hammond case. So in terms of the hacktivist Jeremy Hammond, can you talk a little bit about the significance of Hammond in that particular case? And then maybe, if you want, when you're discussing that, you know, I couldn't help but think of your resistance against the National Defense Authorization Act as another example of resistance against these various totalitarian strains.
Well, I had a special interest in Jeremy Hammond, who's now serving a 10-year prison sentence for hacking into the computers of a private security firm that worked for the Department of Homeland Security. As well, we should not forget, numerous corporations. There's a fusion between these privatized intelligence services like Booz Allen Hamilton and corporations. So Dow Chemical, for instance, used this company.
And Hammond hacked Stratfor.
Yeah, but Stratfor served corporate as well as federal clients. And they handed him one of the longest sentences in U.S. history for hacking. That was intentional with the end of investigative journalism. Because of wholesale surveillance, a reporter cannot speak with any confidentiality to a source within the structures of power who seeks to transmit to the press and the public abuses by power. And that's why Snowden had to flee the country. So the state has gone after these hackers. And Hammond's release of, I think, 5 million emails ended up being used as evidence in my court case, which you mentioned, when I sued Barack Obama over Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act. This is a section of the National Defense Authorization Act that permits the U.S. military to seize U.S. citizens who, quote-unquote, substantially support. That's not a legal term. That's not material support. Substantially support al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or something called associated forces, another nebulous term. Strip them of due process and hold them indefinitely in military detention centers, including in our black sites overseas. And our argument, I was the original plaintiff and then joined by Noam Chomsky and Alex O'Brien, other great activists. Our argument was that once you establish this as law, it will be used against activists and dissidents. And the release by Hammond of those emails showed a conversation between Stratford and Homeland Security where they were trying to tie a group called U.S. Days of Rage, which Alex O'Brien, I believe, founded or was one of the leaders of, with Al-Qaeda. And then if they could, they could use those terrorism laws against those activists. And that, you know, I think was one of the contributing factors that saw Judge Catherine Forrest rule in our favor and denounce the law as unconstitutional, which of course it is. It's clearly within the Constitution. The military is not a domestic policing force and does not have the right to carry out extraordinary rendition on the streets of American cities. The Obama administration appealed, and unfortunately what they did is rather than rule on the merits of the case, which is what they always do, they denied my standing. And the way they did it was I was also a plaintiff in a case before the Supreme Court called Clapper versus Amnesty International, where we were challenging warrantless wiretapping and surveillance by the government before the Snowden revelations. The government said that our concerns were speculation, in their words, and added that if we were being surveilled, the government would inform us. And so after that ruling where the Supreme Court said we didn't have standing or the right to bring the case, the appellate court, the Second Circuit in New York, said, well, Hedges doesn't have standing in Clapper versus Amnesty International, therefore he doesn't have standing in Hedges versus Obama. So they never rule on the merits. This is kind of the game they play, the use of judicial fiat to overturn our constitutional rights. That's how you get the Supreme Court decision of Citizens United, where unlimited campaign contributions are the right to petition the government or a form of free speech. So Hammond, along with WikiLeaks and Chelsea Manning and others, are the last mechanism, the last way that we have to shine a light into the inner workings of power. I mean, Chelsea Manning exposed numerous war crimes. None of the people who committed those war crimes, which she documented, have been investigated, much less charged. And yet she's sitting in Leavenworth with a 35-year sentence. So, yeah, I look at these figures as very courageous. I interviewed Jeremy in jail shortly before he was sentenced and then was in the courtroom when he was sentenced. But we have differences. He's a supporter of the Black Bloc anarchist movement, which I am not. But I certainly admire what he and others have done. And I purposely wanted their voices heard within the book, because when you stand up to these draconian systems of power, there is hell to pay. You know, as many of these people like Jeremy or Mumia Abu-Jamal, who I also interviewed in the prison in Frackville, are paying.
Chris Hedges, you write about Jeremy Hammond and when he was sentenced. I think you make a really good point that you're building on Hammond's statement when he was sentenced, where he says, the acts of civil disobedience that I'm being sentenced for today are in line with the principles of community and equality that have guided my life. He goes on to say, I'm paraphrasing now, that you know he knew what he was doing was against the law. But then he goes on to say, could I have achieved the same goals through legal means?
Right.
I have tried everything from voting petitions to peaceful protests and have found that those in power do not want the truth to be exposed. When we speak truth to power, we are ignored at best and brutally suppressed at worst. And that's pretty much what you were just explaining, even in your experience with your case.
Well, but that is a correct reading of the structures of corporate power. And as Hammond goes on to say in that statement, that we are confronting a power structure that does not respect its own system of checks and balances, never mind the rights of its own citizens or the international community. And Hammond is right.
Chris, you use the terminology sublime madness, and that it's a reflection of the heroes you're talking about, Julian Assange, Chelsea Manning, Jeremy Hammond, and perhaps even yourself, as dedicated people, morally dedicated to challenging the gross inequalities and vastness of empire. What does that mean, and can we... To what degree is people who are heroes interlock with potential movements like Occupy or a new Occupy that really ultimately would be the forces that can challenge empire?
Well, this is a term coined by the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, and it's used quite eloquently in James Cone's masterpiece, The Cross and the Lynching Tree. So Niebuhr writes that in moments of extremity, or when we face what Immanuel Kant calls radical evil, nothing is able to defy the forces of oppression. No one is able to defy the force of oppression, but those who have what he calls a sublime madness in the soul. Because, as Niebuhr writes, nothing but madness will do battle with malignant power and spiritual wickedness in high places. And at moments such as the one we face, this sublime madness is vital, because without it, as Hammond says in that passage we read when he was sentenced, truth is obscured. And Niebuhr also understood that traditional liberalism, in a moment of extremity or facing a system of monolithic and ruthless power, is a useless force, because it, in Niebuhr's words, lacks the spirit of enthusiasm, not to say fanaticism, which is so necessary to move the world out of its beaten tracks. It is, Niebuhr writes, too intellectual and too little emotional to be an effective force in history. And I think that that notion of sublime madness, and I talk about the Zapatistas in the book, you know, a group of no more than about a half dozen gathering to figure out what they're going to do in the face of NAFTA, which not only devastated the American economy, but the Mexican economy, driving, estimates are, 1 to 3 million Mexican farmers off of their land because the agribusinesses were able to flood the market with cheap corn. They went bankrupt, many of them, of course, fleeing to the United States. And that concept of sublime madness, there's just something, this kind of obstinate madness that makes these figures unwilling to compromise and indeed makes them willing to challenge these systems of power at great personal cost. And I think that these rebels are key in moments like this, and that's why I speak a lot about the nature of rebellion and spend a lot of time interviewing figures like Hammond who embody these qualities.
So that's what you mean by the title of your book, Wages of Rebellion and Moral Imperatives of Revolt, the Moral Importance of Revolt. Let's talk a little bit about radical evil. And certainly the war on terror is a justification for some horrendous destruction of human life worldwide and occupying major areas under military control, creating chaos in the world. To what degree do you think that this radical evil incorporates through deep state mechanisms or through intelligence groups, Gladio-type false flag operations?
You know, there's so much that's now carried out by superpower that we have no, we're not even allowed to see their budgets, much less get a glimpse into their activities. I mean, some journalists, Jeremy Scale and others, have done a good job of attempting to expose what's happening. We have very little real idea here. The reign of state terror that we have visited upon Iraqis and Syrians, Pakistanis, Yemenis, Afghanis, that Israel visits on the Palestinians. Everything is told from these largely fictitious narratives from the heart of empire by a press that largely serves as courtiers. So false flags, I mean, there's not much that they won't carry out. I mean, you can take just the assassination of Osama bin Laden. I use the word assassination deliberately. He was unarmed. That's an assassination. That is a war crime. You know, how many narratives have come out? And, you know, an entire movie, Zero Dark Thirty, was filmed, as far as we can tell, on basically a CIA-provided narrative, which was at best self-serving and at worst probably completely fictitious. But that's true within the news media as well. So that's one of the frustrations for those of us who spent as many, I spent 20 years on the outer reaches of empire, is communicating the horror. I mean, that's the last line from Heart of Darkness, where Kurtz's friend Marlowe, who Kurtz dies in the Congo, comes back to Kurtz's fiance, and Kurtz's last words are the horror of the horror. But Marlowe can't bring himself to tell Kurtz's fiance what the words are, because the reality of empire and fictitious narrative that is spun out to justify empire are so vastly at odds that they create an existential crisis within the culture. And you see it with returning combat veterans who are self-aware, because they realize that we're not a virtuous nation. God has not blessed us above others. Victory is not always assured. All of these are lies that have been disseminated by every institution within the society, from schools to churches to government to the entertainment industry. And that's, you know, among, of course, coping with the trauma that they bring back. I think they're also coping, if they're conscious, with the mendacity. And so I think for those of us who spent as long as I did on the outside, we're kind of permanently alienated because we speak a language that to a, perhaps the vast majority of the public is largely unintelligible.
Chris Hedges, riffing a little bit on Peter Phillips' question, what are your thoughts about some of the terminology or the analysis? Like Peter Dale Scott talks about the deep state. David Talbot's new book talks about the rise of America's secret government after the Dulles years and so forth. A lot of these policies, these things that are derived, carried out, a lot of them are deep state or subsurface kind of governmental developments, things that we don't know a lot about in terms of their origin, and something that the corporate news media almost never reports on.
Well, that's very true. And I think that one of the things that is so disturbing about being, as I was, in places like the war in El Salvador or the Contra war in Nicaragua or Iraq or Gaza, is that you see the effects of the deep state, and therefore you glimpse the actual mechanisms of power that are never acknowledged by the state itself. Yes, I think both of those authors have something important to say.
We're speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges. His most recent book is Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. After this brief musical break, we'll continue and conclude our conversation with Chris Hedges. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we've been talking with award-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges. His newest work, Wages of Rebellion, is out now on Nation Books. You can read Chris Hedges' columns at truthdig.com. Chris Hedges, we need to wrap up today's discussion, but could you tell us, you know, again, what is the main thing that you're hoping to achieve with the publication of this book? And of course, you're traveling the country, speaking to people, and you're also an activist on the ground as well as a scholar and author. Talk to us a little bit about where you see things headed. And then let's talk about a real hope, not the cynical co-option of it, as we've seen by the establishment. And what are some of your hopes?
I draw my hope from those movements that have stepped outside the political process to challenge it. Black Lives Matter, the anti-fracking movement, along with many of the other environmental movements, and I'm going to throw in there the movement against the animal agriculture industry, which has not been mentioned in Paris, and with many people argue the most important contributor to global warming, which is why I'm a vegan, the fight to raise the minimum wage. I mean, there are a series of movements that are not appealing to the centers of power, Democrat or Republican, indeed define them, are attempting to mobilize. We've seen it in Canada with Idle No More or the Quebec Students Movement. This is where I get my hope. We build movements to resist and push back against forces that, if left unchecked, will kill us, quite literally. I mean, this is what climate change will do if we don't radically reconfigure our relationship with the environment and, finally, with each other in terms of our levels of consumption and our use of fossil fuels. So that's where hope lies. I've met with a lot of these people. They're incredibly impressive, articulate, politically sophisticated, young. And I think that's where we have to put our energy. You know, it's far more important to invest our time in movements like that than going to a Bernie Sanders rally or chanting, "Yes, we can." The system is gamed. It's fixed against us. And we have to rebuild the radical and progressive movements that were taken from us. And that's happening. It happened in Occupy. The state is not responding rationally to the concerns and needs of the citizenry, which means inevitably there will be blowback. We have to acknowledge the fact that part of that blowback will come in the forms of a right-wing kind of proto-fascist Christian entity. I mean, that is also part of the DNA in the United States. But I see movement. I see consciousness. I think that the entire project of neoliberalism and globalization has been exposed for the lie it is across the political spectrum. That is having frightening consequences on the far right, but very positive consequences on other parts of the political spectrum. And in the end, you know, if we don't stand up and we don't physically resist, then we can't use the word hope.
Chris Hedges, your latest book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with author and journalist Chris Hedges today on Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. And Hedges is always want to go through history and pull out some of the great thinkers, some of the great ideas, and they're woven through his 11 books, including Death of the Liberal Class. And I wanted to point out that Hedges, of course, admirer of many thinkers, George Orwell, one of them, and couldn't help but think throughout the interview today this one quote that that I actually learned about from Hedges. It was a George Orwell quote. I learned about it from The Death of the Liberal Class. This is George Orwell from his unpublished Freedom of the Press Introduction to Animal Farm. It was eventually published in 1972 in the New York Times Literary Supplement, and I think it really sums up a lot of the problems we face here, particularly surrounding media control, propaganda, and so forth. Orwell wrote, "Unpopular ideas can be silenced and inconvenient facts kept dark without the need for any official ban. At any given moment, there is an orthodoxy, a body of ideas which it is assumed that all right-thinking people will accept without question. It is not exactly forbidden to say this, that, or the other, but it is not done to say it. Anyone who challenges the prevailing orthodoxy finds himself silenced with surprising effectiveness. A genuinely unfashionable opinion is almost never given a fair hearing, either in the popular press or in the highbrow periodicals." And of course, at Project Censored for nearly 40 years, that's what we've attempted to highlight, those very journalists, those very authors, those very people who have things to say, and the establishment, the corporate media, they will not give those ideas the light of day for fear of the movements that might be generated from them and the resistance that might be propelled from that honest reporting. Chris Hedges, certainly one of many people that do that kind of honest reporting, and it was an honor to have him on the program today.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
You've been tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on over 25 stations around the U.S., including our newest affiliate in Hawaii. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Ritualized, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks of all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers.